and welcome to Season 12, Episode 23 of the Ubuntu Podcast. I'm here alone with Mark this week. How are you doing, Mark?
Well, you're not alone if you're with me, are you, Alan?
Oh, that's nice, isn't it? I think it is possible to be alone with someone, isn't it?
You're never alone with the Ubuntu Podcast, listeners.
Oh, dear, you're in a good mood today. Yeah, we've got no Martin. He's in... New York, New York, a city so great they named it twice, and he's busy doing work stuff, so he's not gallivanting.
Makes a change.
Although I have seen the photos from the top floors of various buildings in New York, so he seems to be enjoying it while he's there.
Was there Long Island iced tea involved?
I got a message at about 11:30 last night telling me that he's got a Long Island iced tea.
So that was, what, 10 in the morning over there?
Yeah, it's about 5 hours previous. So, no, he seems to be getting on quite well with some very important work that I know nothing about.
That's good to know. Mm. I'm sure we'll not hear all about the top secret details next time.
I don't think it's top secret. It's just stuff. So what have you been up to?
I have been playing Pillars of Eternity again.
What's this one?
Pillars of Eternity is a game which was crowdfunded a few years ago. It's an isometric role-playing game in the style of Baldur's Gate and those sort of old Dungeons & Dragons-themed RPGs.
Is it like pixelated or is it modern style?
It's modern style. It's not like, you know, fully immersive 3D. It's third person isometric sort of fixed point of view, but it's got really really rich graphics and sounds and voice acting and so on. I've been listening to a series. It's actually a YouTube series, but they've also got a podcast of it called Critical Role, which is a Dungeons and Dragons podcast, basically a bunch of friends playing Dungeons & Dragons, but they are also all professional voice actors. And one of the things that they do is the Pillars of Eternity series. So I thought it was worth giving it a playthrough again, because it's one of those games where it's a really long game, but you can play it, you know, very differently depending on, you know, the character you choose and the options that you choose in conversations and so on. So yeah, I thought it was worth another go.
Excellent. And do you play that with the Steam controller on your telly downstairs?
I do.
Ah, is it like well joystick supported, or is it something you had to get a community?
No, there's an official mapping, but I've made some tweaks to it because I think I added it's got mostly controlled with the mouse pointer, so you just use the one of the pads and clicking, and then there's some shortcuts for selecting options in conversations, and then I also added a scroll wheel support, which you can use for zooming in and out and for moving up and down dialogue. And also there's a quick save and quick load feature, which I've mapped to long presses of certain buttons so you don't do it accidentally. But one thing they have done in the game settings is you can change the size of the text that shows up in dialogues. So if you're sitting across the screen from the TV, it's really useful to be able to boost that up to a nice big size so that you can read it.
Oh, nice.
So they have thought about that sort of thing.
And it's available on your favourite retail stores for computer games?
Yeah, it's on Steam, which is where I've got it. But in fact, I think they've just released it for the Nintendo Switch as well, although I don't want to buy it again, so I'm just replaying it on Steam.
All right, well, let's get on with it. And first up in our community news this week, we've got a blog post from Colin King, who is a renowned Ubuntu kernel team developer, works at Canonical. And in this blog post, he's written up some data he's gathered about boot speed. And it's one of those things that we keep coming back to, you know, that
you're always making boot speed faster.
Yeah, you've got to go fast. The problem is it's one of those things that if you don't keep on top of it all the time, you know, sometimes it elongates and additional services get added and then it gets longer and then you come back to it a couple of years later and you have to trim things. Colin's obviously a kernel team developer, so he's looked at kernel-related things. But he, in his blog post, he talks about some of the very specific things at early boot time, talking about loading the kernel image and the initramfs. So like the stuff that happens like pretty much immediately after the bootloader.
Right at the start.
Yeah, really early. And he's written about comparisons between loading your operating system off of spinning Rust or off of an SSD or off of a slow spinning Rust and fast spinning Rust. And they've tried to optimize it to try and make it faster for everyone. It's a difficult balancing act, I think. I find this kind of stuff fascinating. This like internal decisions and yeah, this is just a piece of work that Colin has done. It probably took him an amount of time in order to do all the testing and figure out, you know, how fast the system boots and figure out what optimizations they can make and tweak settings. But I think ultimately they came up with changing the compression scheme is the optimal answer to making it a bit faster. I don't think it's, yeah, it's not going to make a dramatic difference. It's not like suddenly you're going to turn your computer on and you're going to get the login screen immediately. But it's another one of those things that you can chip away at to make it better.
Nice.
Yeah, it's worth a read. It's fairly light. It's not too technical.
That's good.
Yeah, it's worth a read.
Next up, Simos Zenitelis has written an article about LXD talking about how to map ports between the host and containers using LXD proxy devices.
This is something I'd never heard of.
Right, so this is if you've got containers which have a service running inside them, but then you want to expose that service to something which can currently connect to the host but not into the container. Is that right?
Yeah, because I think by default, in LXD land, when you spin up a container, I'm sure this is configurable, but by default, when you spin up a container, you get a NATed address inside the container, like a 10 dot whatever. No other machines on your network can see the services that are running inside that container.
Yes. So this is like port mapping the host into the containers.
Right. And it's quite a simple thing. I mean, it's not rocket science, but it's just a useful thing, especially if you want to containerize all your stuff. And I've never thought of doing this. I have a home server and I have everything just running on the host. I haven't containerized anything. And every so often I think, oh, when I redo this, I'm going to containerize everything. and just because I want to be able to make sure everything's siloed and I could easily move things from one place to another. If it's containerized, I can just pick that up and move it somewhere else. But the default of not being able to actually, you know, expose a port from inside the container to the outside world. I'd not even looked into it, but I didn't realize it was as easy as Simos's blog post shows.
Yeah, so I've done this on my home server. I've done this with snaps, which tend to, I suppose, it depends on how they're configured, but in the case of the snaps I use, the main ones being Nextcloud and Plex Media Server, they expose a port locally, so you can access that. I think you can access them remotely as well, but it's not necessarily on the port you'd want to. So you would have to open that port in your firewall or add port forwarding on your network. So I've done that by using Nginx as a reverse proxy.
Oh, in front of them.
Exactly. So you have a / Nextcloud then goes to the local port where Nextcloud is running.
Then.
Yeah, so externally, I think I've actually disabled it so that, yeah, externally you can't access the Nextcloud service directly on its own port. You can only do it via the reverse proxy.
And I guess you could add, if you wanted to, additional authentication within Nginx.
Yeah, and I mean, I add SSL there, so or TLS, so it's accessed locally. It's not running it's not running encryption on the web server, but Nginx adds that, and then the reverse proxy bit isn't encrypted. So the public facing bit adds the encryption as well.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, so worth looking at this blog post from Simos if you're interested in containerizing all your things. Next up, friend of the show, Martin Wimpress, has updated the Mate Optimus Indicator applet recently. It's got picked up by OMG Ubuntu and a few other places. So this is a handy little thing that sits in the corner of the screen. Did Martin say you had some influence over this, or you suggested it should exist or something?
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I tried out a device. We were reviewing a device and I tried out Ubuntu Mate on it, and it had an NVIDIA Optimus GPU in it. And my piece of feedback for Martin was that it was too much of a pain to switch between them. And I think there was an indicator which showed you that you could do it, but all it did was then launch the utility for doing it. And then you selected the option and then you had to know to reboot to actually make the change. Whereas now it shows you the options in the indicator and you can select them and then it tells you you need to reboot. So he's taken my feedback on board and I no longer own a device which I can use this on because I don't have anything with an NVIDIA Optimus chip.
This is very much a thing that Martin needs in his life, because having seen the pile of laptops that he has.
And the pile of graphics cards.
Yes. I mean, this is very common on, you know, modern high-end laptops that have multiple GPUs. They have the like GPU on the Intel CPU and also a discrete GPU as well, and you want to be able to switch between them if you want battery endurance or high performance. And I saw, interestingly, when we were in Arizona a few weeks ago, he had the laptop that he's got on loan from Dell, which I think he'll be reviewing next time he's on. And I think that's got the dual GPU thing. And he was fiddling around having both of the GPUs running at the same time, which was weird. He had two GLX gears running on the screen, and one was being rendered by one GPU and one was being rendered by the other, which was all very wacky. But yeah, that's a bit of an extreme case. But this switching applet thing has got support for NVIDIA on demand and displays which of the OpenGL renderers are in use, and then prompts you, rather than you having to go and hunt down and know that you've got to restart, as you said, it prompts you if you're going to switch GPU, because that's one of the limitations, you have to log out. But that's good.
Yeah, very impressed.
That'll be included in 1910, I guess.
Cool.
Some more news about 1910, I believe.
Yes, the Yaru theme will be light by default. So Yaru is the new ish theme and icon set and so on for the Ubuntu desktop, and it's now going to, so at the moment it's kind of like a hybrid thing where you've got light title bars and the panel, but then the actual window contents, sorry, other way around, you've got dark title bars but then the actual contents of the window is light.
The easiest way to see this is on a modern install of Ubuntu. If you're using Yaru, open the system settings thing and the contents of the window are all, you know, light gray.
Yes.
And the title bar across the top is, what is that color? Is that just dark gray? It's like kind of,
yeah, I think it's a dark gray
slate, probably, I think.
But then, yeah, so I think the default is going to be like this, and then there's also going to be a separate dark mode as well
to make it consistent, a proper dark mode, so the contents of the window are dark as well as the title bar.
Yeah.
The default's going to be light, though.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Interesting. I think I got lost in the GitHub issues when I clicked through this. And this is a thing I love about the Yaru theme and all the work that's gone on this, is it all done in the open. There's discussions on the community discourse, and then there's discussions in the GitHub tracker. And, you know, someone files an issue and says, this button isn't very readable, can we do something about that? Lengthy conversation with mock-ups and, you know, this is how I think we should solve it. And then the net result is they've changed it. I think also there were some conversations with app developers and conversations at Guadec. So, you know, it was a real team effort, making sure they got all the input from the right people to make it right. And that debuts in 1910, I guess, which is not far away.
Well, yes, and let's see if it survives till the LTS release.
Oh, yeah, true. Finally in the news, the Librem 5 phone finally ships.
Does it?
No. The latest target is Q3 2019, and in a recent post, they've said, well, it's now Q3, so we better start shipping. And so they've set a date of, I think, 25th of September. So that's comfortably within Q3. But they've done a bit of a strange thing in that they're doing them in batches. They're going to let some people have their crowdfunded device, like, initially in the first batch. And these will have less well-fitting cases, not as good engineered cases, maybe, as the next batch, where they'll be iterating on it, improving it. You know, like with any product where you make a prototype and you improve it, and engineering samples and you improve it. And then there's a few more patches after that, leading all the way through till sometime mid to late 2020, when the final people get theirs.
Okay, so if you opt for one of the first batch and you've got the one that falls apart, do you then get one of the proper ones when they're done?
I don't believe so. That's your phone. You've got your phone now. You don't get another one.
Right.
Given that they're like £600-700.
So this sounds to me like it's a ploy to make people say, oh no, don't worry, save me until the last batch. And they hope that as many people as possible say that, and then they get away with not shipping the phones for another year.
If we were being fair, then I would say it's a method to spread out people who have different requirements. So if you are the kind of person who wants an end user device, a retail device, then you should wait until next, like, September or whenever it is. But if you're okay with having a thing that's
a dev kit, essentially.
Yeah, you might take it out of the case and just leave it on your desk if you're going to muck about with it and write apps for it. It might not be your primary device. You might be writing apps for it, in which case, does it really matter that it doesn't look like a retail device? So I think being fair, I think that's what the spread of these devices are, is matching the backers with the kind of device that they're set meets their expectations. Being unfair, I would say they should have told everyone this from day one.
Yes.
Because this is not unusual in crowdfunders for devices to be go out in batches for the early backers to get early dev devices, which, you know, the case might be a bit gnarly or might not be as good production quality, or it might be a kit that you have to put together yourself, right? But those crowdfunding campaigns tell you that at the start. I don't think it's reasonable to tell people you're doing that in the quarter that you're supposed to be shipping the devices. That's unreasonable in my book.
Yes, I would agree with you on that. And in fact, you like when I've seen like a lot of crowdfunders where you have this sort of thing, it's a separate option. You don't say, I'm going to buy the phone, and then you get the first batch of shonky phones. You say, I'm going to have the dev kit phone, which isn't going to be like a retail phone.
Yeah, usually there's different tiers where you pick, you know, and sometimes the early birds get the cheap ones.
Yes, which is, you know, that's the option they chose, so that's fine.
But somebody else might say, well, no, I want a retail device, in which case they've chosen that. But that was 2 years ago when you paid your money, not the month when they're supposed to be shipping. So we'll have to wait and see what these are actually like when they get into people's hands, because obviously nobody's got these devices other than dev kits, and see how people feel about them. All right, that's all the community news. We've got a couple of events to talk about. First up, Og Camp. We've mentioned it a few times. It's coming up fast. 19th to 20th of October in Manchester, UK. You can find out everything you need to know by going to ogcamp.org. They've got a shiny new Discord server. So for those people who like using Discord to communicate with the community, you can jump on the Discord server and chat with the other people who are going, you know, organize your travel, figure out who's going to which hotel and all that kind of stuff. Just a nice way to, for everyone to keep chatting before the event and after. There's also a Telegram channel that has existed for a couple of years as well. So, you know, you just pick whichever client you want and we'll see you all there 19th to the 20th in Manchester.
There's also the Linux Application Summit, which is happening on the 11th to the 15th of November in 2019 in Barcelona, Spain.
People have been submitting talks for this, and it's all about bringing more people and applications to the Linux platform. So that'll be cool. It's a collaboration between KDE and GNOME as well. So previously it was a GNOME event, and it's a real collaboration across a whole bunch of projects. So that's good to see.
And there is a talk about Clear Linux, which is an Intel Linux distribution, which we mentioned on the show a while ago. And this is happening on the Saturday, the 2nd of November at 3:30 p.m. at the Harcourt Hotel in Dublin. And this is hosted by the Dublin Linux community.
Awesome. We'll put a link to that in the show notes if you're in the Dublin area and want to go along in November. I think that's all of the events. And now it's time for some news. And first up in the news, the first bunch of Pine phones are going to be shipping soon.
Wow, are they?
Apparently, yes. yes. And the title of their September update is "The PinePhone is real and shipping soon." Mm. I don't know if that's a stab at anyone in particular. But yes. The interesting thing about the way the PinePhone people are doing it is they ship a device and it's up to you to go and find your operating system, basically. There's a number of options.
Yeah, there's going to be a few phases of this where I think the initial one has like a debugging OS. This is like specifically aimed at OS developers. And then there's another batch aimed at early adopters, which is, yeah, install your own OS. And then later on, I think there will be options which come pre-installed.
But it's the same hardware.
Yes, it sounds like it, yeah.
It's just they're just selling them in batches because, yeah, they're quite a small company. They're doing batches, I think, for the same reason that Purism are doing them. It's like, you know, financially sensible to figure out how many people there are who want your device and then build that, you know, spin the factory up for that many. And there are a few operating systems you could potentially have: Ubuntu Touch, Postmarket OS, Plasma Mobile, and Sailfish.
So I think we mentioned Postmarket OS a few months ago as it's like an alternative phone OS, and then Plasma Mobile is providing the interface on top of that, by the sound of it, which looks quite cool. And there's been some photos of Plasma Mobile running on the phone as well, which is quite exciting to see.
Yeah, it's good to see. I mean, it's difficult because we haven't got these things in our hands.
Well, yeah, yeah. We want to see people with these phones and know what they're like, really.
Yeah, but it's all the other stuff around them, like building apps and, you know, do they have app stores for these things? And I know Ubuntu Touch does. They've got the Open Store and so on. And Sailfish does as well. I don't know what the others do, whether you can install I would assume Postmarket OS supports F-Droid and maybe some others. So yeah, it's about, you know, the whole ecosystem around the device, and it's quite exciting times with, you know, both Pure OS and Purism and the PinePhone. It's fun.
Yeah.
Next up, Nextcloud have highlighted some case studies of three EU governments using Nextcloud.
Ooh, this is cool. Yeah, it's been sort of adopted in various public sector organisations and particularly governmental departments, I think they're talking about here.
Yeah, so they've listed the French Ministry of the Interior, the German federal government, and the Swedish government. And they highlight in some quotes from these organisations, you know, for example, the Swedish government say they want to have control over the information and consequences of not having access to the information should be considered from the perspective of national security and sovereignty. So, you know, they're doing it for all the right reasons that, you know, we try and lobby our councils and our government organizations to try and use, you know, open source and open standards. And this is great, seeing this come from Nextcloud, you know, tooting their trumpet that actually you can see this stuff being used in, you know, business.
Yeah, and the French and German governments both said that they've got a big focus on security, which is what led them to choose it and did a lot of auditing around it. But as a result of that, they're self-hosting within their network, and they're each serving about 300,000 employees, which is a significant user base.
Yeah, you're not gonna snap install Nextcloud for that, are you?
Exactly. I mean, yeah, where we're running Moodle at work, that's probably targeting something around 150,000 users.
That's a significant install.
It's, yeah, it really is. So it's really, really cool to see that people are using it for that and that it can cope with that kind of significant workload as well.
Yeah, totally.
Next up, some more good news. Microsoft has announced that it will support the addition of XFAT into the Linux kernel.
What?
I know.
It's cats and dogs living together. What is going on?
So this is one of the big things when Microsoft started saying Microsoft Heart Linux and joined the Open Innovation Network, is a lot of the long-standing critics said, oh, well, we'll believe it when they add the patents for XFAT in, and then people can use it without getting charged for patent fees. And now they've done that. They haven't said that they're actually going to contribute the code. They've said they will support contribution of the code to the Linux kernel. So it's not going to be a separate fuse file system. It will actually be part of the kernel. And they will, they want the a future version of the Linux system definition from the Open Innovation Network, which is all of the stuff that's covered by the reciprocal patent agreement, to include XFAT as part of that, which means that any of the licensees of OIN will then be able to use this essentially patent free.
I think it's going to come a time, probably towards the end of the year, when we start doing our predictions for 2020, where we have to start thinking of what's the next thing that people are going to bitch to Microsoft about. Like, every time that Microsoft Heart Linux comes along, you know, people are like, oh, well, yeah, they still make money out of Android, and oh, well, yeah, but I wonder what the next one's going to be. And I wonder if Microsoft are tracking these and they're ticking them off the list, going, yes, we've done that, we've done that, okay, next one, we've done that, we've done that as well, okay, now will you like us, please like us.
Excellent. Yes, so yeah, we'll see what they do next. Finally, Firefox have announced a VPN extension for their desktop browser they're calling Firefox Private Network.
What does this do that other VPNs don't? Integrated into the browser.
Yes, and it's Firefox branded, so I think the Mozilla have been pushing quite hard recently to make Firefox not just a browser, but a brand and a suite of services that I think has an image and hopefully trust associated with it. So I think that's probably what they're going for here. They're, you know, you can trust this one because it's the Firefox one, I'm hoping, is what they're after here.
As opposed to all those dodgy VPNs owned by shadowy organizations.
Yes. So they've said that this is currently free for a limited time and US only. So I don't know. I assume that means both that it will be open to other parts of the world and you'll have to pay for it in the long run.
Well, I guess it's something we need to keep an eye on. I mean, obviously, we personally can't test it. I mean, I'm interested to know if any of our listeners stateside have tried this. And
yes, that will be really interesting to hear.
Yeah, hear feedback on how it performs and whether it anonymizes you in any way, or, you know, whether it's reliable, whether there's any bandwidth constraints and all that kind of stuff.
So notably, the actual service itself is provided by a partnership with Cloudflare, and they make a point about them not retaining data and so on, and it being privacy protecting. But I expect some people will have some things to say about that.
Yeah, well, yes. In fact, I heard about this on Mastodon the other day when someone said, "Ooh, Firefox are doing a VPN. This looks interesting." And then immediately replied to their own toot saying, "Oh, wait, it's Cloudflare. Never mind." I thought, oh, okay.
Yeah, that might not provide the same brand identity that they were hoping for by calling it Firefox Private Network. But yeah, we'll see how it goes down.
I wonder if part of the reason for having it branded is that they might use different products underneath the covers.
That could be, maybe different ones in different territories. Yeah, could be.
We shall have to wait and see. And that's the end of the news.
We know you've got a Facebook account, so stop sharing cat photos for a moment and like or share our posts so your friends and family can find the Ubuntu podcast.
And that's it for episode 23. Thank you for listening, everyone. Come back, Martin. All is forgiven. But not next week.
Although we do have a friend joining us for a chat next week.
We are. We're going to have Kyle Fazari from the Ubuntu Robotics team.
Awesome. That sounds amazing.
It's got robots. It must be brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.